Okay, let us begin. It's already 9 o'clock. I just want to, as always, begin, respond to some comments and questions. In fact, let me lower the brightness here. You can see me better with the eyes. I just want to call attention to, first of all, respond to some questions still that go from last semester and call your attention to some things. Here's a book that just came out. Soret Bidan HaModerni, Chachamim Sfaradim, Sephardic Chachamim in Recent Generations. This is really excerpts of the writings of Eliyahu ben Amozig, who we'll deal with, the Ben Ish Chai, Rebbe Tzion Aziel, Rav Yosef Messas, and others. So we're dealing with Rav Yisrael Moshe Chazan now, so I think people might find this interesting also if you're interested in the whole Sephardic approach. One person emailed me about, towards the end, we were discussing Kohels and everything, and I just want to clarify at least my opinion. Everyone obviously can have their own opinion. Nothing I said has anything to do, it only refers to situations where the man can't make a living. But if you have a Kohel that pays a living wage, then that's, at least as far as I'm concerned, that's the same thing as working. Last semester, I quoted something very interesting, not last semester, a few semesters ago, and then I quoted, I came back to it, and I'll come back to it again next week, how Bruya Huttner David, in her dissertation on Ritzvi Hirschchayas, points out that Ritzvi Hirschchayas makes a big deal about how the name Raziel is not a Talmudic name, it's a Gaonic name. And she notes that the name Raziel appears throughout the Zohar, so what Ritzvi Hirschchayas is telling us, without explicitly telling us, is that the Zohar cannot be an ancient work because the name Raziel was only seen in the Gaonic times and after. Interesting, fascinating. That's Chayas' opinion. But Chaim Landerer pointed out something very interesting to me, that the name Raziel is actually found on these incantation bowls, these magical incantation bowls, what they used to make magic through these bowls. And these date to the 5th century CE. So leaving aside Chayas' own view about the Zohar, and I'll get back to Rabbi Soloveitchik's view next class, Chayas was actually wrong about this incantation business. A number of you were very interested in Rabbi Kafach. Two books came out by him in the last year. One I'll talk about next class. The other one, it's really just online. A student asked Rabbi Kafach, I don't know, something like 350 questions. I can send anyone who's interested the PDF of these questions. It's full of interesting stuff. Just to give you one example, which we would have discussed if we were still dealing with Rav Kafach. Rav Kafach was asked about the Heter Mechira, selling the land during the Shemitah year, and he thinks it's absolutely forbidden. I find that quite fascinating. He thinks it's forbidden to shave with a razor. But then he's asked about abortion. After 40 days, when there's a problem with the baby, and he concludes that until the baby can live on its own, the fetus can live on its own, which is, we call that viability, which today is defined, I don't know, doctors can correct me, I think it's about 23 weeks, maybe 22 weeks even now, so over 5 months, Rabbi Kafach, and he hasn't quoted Sicily Ezra, that's the Sicily Ezra's position, believes that abortion is permissible. So that's interesting. Two more comments about previous classes. A number of you emailed me over the summer about the tzitzis. We spoke about the Moroccan view of wearing tzitzis. I never mentioned this, so I'll mention it now, that if you look in the Rambam, Hilchos Tzitzis, Perek 3, Halacha Yud Aleph, he speaks about how you're not obligated to buy tzitzis, and then he says, but the chassid, the one who is pious, he should not exempt himself from tzitzis. So it seems that for the Rambam also, just like in the Moroccan tradition, where it wasn't that everyone wore tzitzis, it's just the elites, the pious, whereas our practice is to give it to everyone, even give it to three-year-old kids, the Rambam makes a point of saying that the pious should not exempt themselves from tzitzis. So I think that's, as I said, a good support to the Moroccan approach. I want to raise the light a tiny bit here, if it's okay. I can see the comments that you sent to me. Let me raise it up a bit here. Well, the problem, good point. The problem is that you don't have his logic in these. They're more simple questions. But I think he might say that, I mean, everyone has discussed this Rambam because it's very problematic. It seems to contradict himself and other places. And if you look in the Sridiyesh and others, they say the Rambam doesn't really mean Rodef. And so you'd have to see his explanation. But that's an excellent question, excellent point. By the way, for those who are interested, I just mentioned Chaim Landrieu. That is him right there, one of the young, great bibliophiles and scholars we have. One more point before we begin. We spoke last semester about Rav Shalom Messas. Many things we spoke about him, and we dealt with the shadel business, his defense of the shadel. I neglected to point out to you an amazing responsum. This is in Volume 2, number 17. He's responding to another rabbi who wrote a whole piece about against shadels, and he goes so far as to say, let's look at modest countries. He says, look at Iran, how the women dress, look how the Catholic nuns dress. They don't wear shadels, they cover their hair. In Iran, you don't see them wearing shadels, they cover their hair. And Rav Messas, this is on page 253, he really goes to town on this. He thinks, what a disgrace to compare a holy people, that is the Jews, with those Hargein Nefashot, the Adim Katanim, the Milchamal, with the Iranians who kill people left and right, who send children into the minefields and everything. And he goes on and on that it's a disgrace for any rabbi to try to bring a proof how Jewish women should dress by how women are dressing either in the church or in Iran. I know many of you were interested in his defense of shadels, so that's that. Ah, and one more thing before we start. A lot of you email me about the antinomian business. I don't want to get into it now because when we deal with Rav Tzadok, I'll have time to get into it in more details. But as they say, I can't leave you with nothing, so let me just give you one more interesting tidbit. And take it for what it's worth. Chaim Grada, who I assume is reliable. I don't think anyone's ever said he's not reliable. We spoke a good deal about him in his description of the Chazon Ish, which everyone who knew the Chazon Ish agrees is a wonderful description. He studied at the various Musar yeshivas. He claims that in the Vardic yeshiva, there were young men there who did not put on tefillin. Not because they were, like you had people in the great yeshivas who just were not religious. They were in yeshivas for reasons other than learning Torah. The Netziv actually slapped the boy's face because he thought that he shaved with a razor. We have examples of that. That's not the reason. They thought that, according to Grada, again, so take, believe it if you want, they thought that they had reached Beirur V'Tikun Hamidot HaNoshiot. They thought that they had reached a level of perfection that they didn't need to wear tefillin. I mean, everyone knows that in the great yeshivas, you had a mini-antinomianism that people did not go to Tefillah B'Tzibur. They'd be up learning so much, and they said their attitude was that since I'm learning, I don't need to go to Tefillah B'Tzibur. And we'll see today, I think, if not today, next class, what Rishon Moshe Chazan says about Tefillah B'Tzibur. But, so that's, I guess, a mini-antinomianism. But to say they didn't wear tefillin, I don't know. But that's what Chaim Grada says. Okay. Let us begin. I want to begin with two clarifications. First, David Eisen from last week made an interesting point. I was wondering why Rabbi Shlomo Moshe Chazan refers to himself as Mashiach, or that's actually maybe should be seen as Masiach, like as in Sicha. The problem is sometimes people address him letters, they call him Maran Mashiach. And David suggested that maybe he didn't want to say Yud Mem Chet, Yisrael Moshe Chazan, Yamach. And I thought that might be, because that's like to just, words of destruction, Yamach Shemo. And I thought that maybe is a good point, but the more I think about it, it's not, because he wouldn't say Yamach, he would have said Yismach, Yisrael. And one place, at least one place, he does refer to himself as Yismach. So I don't know. I don't know what to make of why he would use such an interesting expression. And as I said, that's how he's known, as Harav Mashiach. One more point. We ended last class about the Reform movement in England, and I wasn't clear. I said that I misspoke. I said that the Reform movement in England they wouldn't call people up by their names. And that's the truth in Germany. In German Reformed synagogues, they did not call people up by names. They thought it was undignified. Instead, they gave them a card, and then they called up by numbers, and they also read the Torah in the Sephardic way. That's in England, in Germany. In England, they actually didn't call people up to the Torah at all. They just read the Torah. So that's obviously not in accord with halacha. And that's where we really ended last class. I think the last thing I said was that Yisrael Moshe Chazan comes to London and you have this nascent reform movement and they decide to break away and make their own synagogue, abolish the second day of Yom Tov. And I pointed out that the reform movement in Germany, which is beginning around the same time, was not really an influence on what was going on in England. What was going on in England was a Sephardic phenomenon. The scholars who studied it do not see any influence of Germany on what was going on in England. They mention Germany in one of their petitions. They say that we want to do like they do in Germany, but they came to this on their own, independently. So after they set forth their position, the elders of the community in London refused to sanction opening the branch synagogue. Remember what we said, this originally begins because they live too far away. Moses Montefiore used to walk 4 miles to synagogue on Shabbos. And these people are living far away. They want to open up their own shul. The community refuses to let them. And as long as the community refuses to let them, and they're going to make their own shul anyway, they begin to start talking about various reforms. Had the community allowed them to open a branch synagogue, these reforms never would have happened. In 1840, they meet and they open up their own synagogue. They call it the Synagogue of British Jews, soon to be abandoned. They appoint a person, his name is Marx, David Marx, to be their minister, their rabbi. He composes a new prayer book to them. In response to this, the leaders of the Sephardic community, a chacham named David Meldola, the Meldola family is a very important family. He is the son of Rafael Meldola, who... author of Responsa. He wrote a work, Chupa Chatanim, which is reprinted often, I believe. It's a work on marriage. When I say often, it's been reprinted a number of times, an important Sephardic authority. So both he and the chief rabbi of the Ashkenazic community, whose name was Solomon Herschel. Solomon Herschel is the son of Rav Zvi Hirschleben of Berlin, the brother of those who listened to Dan Rabinowitz's lecture the other night. You heard about the Besamim Rosh. This is the brother of the Besamim Rosh. They immediately put them in Cherem. They declare that the new synagogue violates halacha, and whoever uses the new prayer book is regarded as sinful. They declare that further that this prayer book denies the oral law. And when the new synagogue was opened up shortly after that, all these people are put in Cherem. So what does it mean to be put in Cherem in England in the mid-19th century? Today, if we decide to put the Reformed Jews in the Cherem, they wouldn't care. What do they care if we put them in Cherem? What does it mean? Well, it's a very different situation, especially in the Sephardic world. Just think of a traditional Sephardic community where you have all different levels of observance. If you put people in Cherem, they're not going to be too happy about that because, first of all, it means that they're disqualified from all offices in the community. They couldn't be called to the Torah or included in the minyan. These are people who basically were proud Jews, observant Jews, but they just wanted some changes. A little different sitter. They wanted to abolish the second day of Yom Tov. But we're not talking about people who are saying we're going to abolish Shabbos and stop eating kosher like they were doing in Germany. Furthermore, and most important, those families who were under the Cherem, their children could no longer marry with other members of the community. So everyone who's a member of this synagogue, their children could not marry with anyone else. Any other Jews in England. Because the rabbis controlled marriage at that time. So they had no one to marry. They also could not be buried in the communal cemetery. The Sephardim had their cemetery. Well, a number of influential members of the community, that is, of the non-Cherem community, that is, the general Sephardic community, put pressure on the rabbis to revoke this Cherem, because as you can imagine, it created great tension. You had family members who now were regarded as separate from one another. You had brothers who and children who now were regarded as having been put under the ban. So there was a lot of communal pressure, and in 1849, 7 years after the Cherem was instituted, the cherem was officially lifted. By the way, the Reformed Jews, by that time, they had become even more Reform. They didn't change anything, but the cherem had to be lifted. Well, Chazan, Sir Moshe Chazan, was in London at this time, and he becomes aware of the Reformers. And in 1845, he publishes a little booklet. It's included in this giant volume that I showed you last class, the one that my friend, I don't know, some 2,000 pages of all the writings of Yisrael Moshe Chazan. It's a Hebrew-English pamphlet, someone translating to English, and it's not a condemnation as much as a call upon the Reformers to rejoin the traditional community. I checked, this pamphlet is not on any of the, I didn't check Google Books, but it's not on Hebrew Books, and it's not on Otsar HaChachma. He then leaves London shortly after that, and in 1846, he's in Amsterdam, where he publishes a book, Kinat Zion, which is strongly against Reform. That you can find on HebrewBooks.org. And in 1855, he publishes another text. This time it's called Kedushat Yom Tov. I'll show you the let me show you the title page here of it. This is an entire volume. He heard what was going on in Germany and other places to abolish Yom Tov Sheni. So he publishes an entire book, a defense of Yom Tov Sheni. People were complaining that it makes business hard for them, which it does, and there's no reason anymore. We have a calendar. You've all heard the arguments. I said last week that maybe the best explanation we can give today is it's a punishment for living in the Gullus. But truthfully, I don't believe that. I don't see it as a punishment. I actually... maybe because I'm not in a job where I only have 2 weeks vacation a year, and if I use them on Yom Tov Sheni, then I can't take my family on a trip. But I'm not in that situation, so I like Yom Tov Sheni. I enjoy it. But this is an entire defense of the necessity, why we need Yom Tov Sheni. Now, Yaakov Katz has an entire article on the battle over Yom Tov Sheni. It's in his book of essays. And he sees this kuntras by Chazan as quite significant. As I'll explain, what makes it significant? Well, what Chazan says, his approach is significant. First of all, Chazan understands that people are going to open their stores on the second day of Yom Tov. They weren't opening on the first day, but they were going to open it on the second day. And he knows that this can't be stopped, so he develops a notion that today we take for granted. But it was quite a new idea in Chazan's day. He wants to distinguish violations of halacha from heresy. Like I said, we make these assumptions all the time. We have plenty of people come to our shuls. We have people come to our shuls who drive on Shabbos, some of our shuls, and we distinguish between violations and heresy. He tells the people in this kuntras, he tells them that if you're going to open your stores knowing that it's a sin. Trying to get rid of Yom Tov Sheni is undermining Judaism. It's a heretical thing. That we can't live with. If you want to be, I guess we'd call him today, a non-observant Orthodox Jew, that's okay. You're doing wrong, but at least you recognize you're doing wrong and you still want to be part of the community. You're still in our community. However, once you say that you're going to uproot it and say it's not valid, then you're not in our community. You're an outcast. You're a heretic. And that really became the Sephardic approach. The Sephardic community is full of people of different levels of observance, but they never attempted to uproot anything. It was just as individuals. They didn't do everything. Some didn't do this, some didn't do that. But they recognize as a community that there's standards which they choose not to observe. Yisrael Moshe Chazan is maybe the first person to really articulate this idea that we want you in our community, no matter what you're doing on Yom Tov, as long as you accept the practice. What you do in your own life, fine, we'll deal with that. Just don't try to abolish it, because then you've moved into heresy. Okay, Hebrew Books calls it Moshe Yisrael Chazan. As I mentioned last class, in one or two of his kuntresim, including the Divrei Shalom Ve'emet, he calls himself Moshe Yisrael. And we saw last time one of his tshuvot he calls himself that. But 90% of the time he calls himself Yisrael Moshe. Why he went back and forth, I have no idea. Chazan even says that these people who violate Yom Tov Sheni, you can, and this would actually also lead to Yom Tov Rishon for many of them, you can even count them as part of the Yom Tov Minyan. That is, they can come to shul we can count them in the minion, and then they can go to their stores as long as they accept the fact that what they're doing is incorrect. And whatever reason they're doing it, because the classic distinction is mumar l'tayavon v'mumar l'hachlis. If someone's violating the law because they want to make more money, that we can deal with. If they're violating the law because they think it's stupid or it's not binding, that's no good, and those people are not part of our community. That's true. And Rabbi Kellen points out that there are no non-Orthodox movements. I mentioned a number of times that Rabbi Soloveitchik often wondered, and he said publicly, that maybe the Chasam Sofer made a mistake. Maybe if the Chasam Sofer hadn't been so stringent and so strong, if you recall what the early reformers were interested in, they weren't interested in such crazy reforms. The things they were interested in would work very well in our shuls. Had he not adopted an approach of Chadash Asr Min HaTorah, maybe we could have kept them in the fold. But then after saying that, the Rav said, but you know, on the other hand, maybe if he hadn't done that, they would have been even more successful in moving into the Orthodox world. It's hard to say, but we certainly can look at communities in the Sephardic world, not just the Sephardic world, even in Holland, which is an Ashkenazi community, and they prevented the development of a reform movement, which was very important. It kept certain standards. So in retrospect, we might judge the Sephardic approach as the better approach. But as Dov points out, and this is also important, you didn't have, in most of the Sephardic world, the ideologies that were moving the reform movement. So it's really hard to say what would have happened. Yeah, the Rav was very forceful on the Machitza issue. He thought that was a boundary marker between conservative Judaism. It wasn't reform. He thought that we had to take a stand between conservative Judaism, and this is the way to do it. When we deal with Rav Henkin later this semester or next semester, you'll see that Rav Henkin disagreed. Rav Henkin thought that you could go to a shul without a machitza if there's no other shul. And I'll talk more about Rav Schechter quotes the Rav as saying some very interesting stuff about the machitzas that would imply that some of this was merely for rhetoric. How else do you explain that the Rav would tell other people that if you ask me, I'm going to tell you you can't go to the shul, so ask another Rav. I mean, when the Rav says that, it tells you there's more here than meets the eye. Chazan argues that the whole business of Yom Tov Sheni is not even a minhag. It's a takana, it's a decree of the sages, which is, if you look in the Rambam, he's not clear. The Rambam uses both languages of the language of custom and also the language of decrees. But since it's a takana, since it's a decree of the sages, Chazan says that there is simply no way we can abolish it. It's a non-starter. He even says, and this gets back to what Rav Itzala said last week, he says that if all the rabbis get together and declare that we're going to abolish Yom Tov Sheni, the people will not listen. The people will refuse to listen to the rabbis. Another example of the sense of the faithful, from Yisrael Moshe Chazan. The people know that this is essential to Judaism, and the rabbis have no authority to void it. So I think that's quite fascinating. Leaving Amsterdam, Rav Yisrael Moshe Chazan makes his way to Lisbon, Portugal. Jews were expelled from Portugal in the 15th century. Shortly after the expulsion from Spain, they begin to return to Portugal at the beginning of the 19th century. From there, he goes to Livorno and Leghorn, and in 1847, he comes to Rome. He impresses the Jews of Rome. Remember, he's traveling around Europe. He's on Shlichus Mitzvah. He can do lots of things. He can influence Jews like the Chidah. He can collect money for the land of Israel. Basically, he left Israel, as we saw last week, because he was sort of forced to leave Israel because of disputes with the Abbasin. So he's in Rome. The Jews of Rome are very impressed with him, and they appoint him chief rabbi of Rome, where he remains for 5 years. As is often the case, he has problems with the community leaders after 5 years. And from Rome, he goes to Corfu, the island of Corfu, and from there becomes rabbi in Alexandria, Egypt, returns to the land of Israel shortly after that, and dies in 1863, a relatively young man. In the world of halacha, he's best known for his volume, Krach Shel Romi. It's a play on an expression in the Talmud, the city of Rome. This work was published in the mid-19th century, or actually late 19th century. It's quoted a lot by Sephardic authorities, but you have no way, until a few years ago, no one could see this work. because where could you see this work? A work that's published in the second half of the 19th century, I think in the 1870s. And you're, let's say, when I came to the university in the 1980s, who had this work? It's been out of print for 100 years. Brandeis University, where I was, did not have a copy of it. We didn't have, you know, the microfilms and the DVDs and the CD-ROMs and all that. I saw references to it in Ravadi Yosef, never saw it. Until I went to Harvard and they had an original copy, I had never seen a copy of the Krach Sharama. Yes, you can get it in the JTS library, but I was living in Boston, so I didn't go down there. You have it in a few libraries, but you couldn't take it out of the JTS library. You could actually take it out of the Harvard library, but if you wanted to have your own copy, it was very hard. And then they put all these works. Harvard did an amazing thing when I was there. They took all of their books, about 100 years old and older. They started removing them from the shelves, and there was a million-dollar project, multi-million-dollar, of making microfiche of thousands and thousands of books. This place in Zug in Switzerland, and they came out with this amazing set, which they were charging, I don't know, $50,000. All the rare responsa, and maybe some big libraries bought it. Just a couple of years after that, we had the technology to digitalize. You had Hebrewbooks.org, Otsar HaChachma. It was an incredible waste of money, but of course, who knew? No one's ever going to use these. The investment from this company, and at Harvard put in money also to put everything on microfiche. Now, it's true, if there's some rare Haskalah books that you want, they're not on Hebrewbooks.org, you can get them from the microfiche, but it's only a matter of time before they're on Google Books. While I was at Harvard, the same time, a group of Satmar Hasidim in Borough Park began a project, which also they didn't know what was coming, but they made Parnassa on this for a few years, to take all these old rare books, books that haven't been in print for years, and reprint them. They made a master copy, printed 25 copies, but any copy then you wanted, they had a master copy, you just call up Eagle Eyes in New York, and they print you out for $25, they print you out your own copy. One of the books they printed, 1991, here it is, Krach Shalromi. Anyone wants to have their own copy, you can just call up Eagle Eyes, and he'll get it for you, published in 1991. For me, it was a day of rejoicing, because I remember when they came out with this and they had sent it to me, finally I could take it to Shul. I could go through literally every page with my notes. Here is a book that hadn't been available for the public for 110, 115 years. So it was a great thing. Let me see what you got here. Ah, very nice. And that comes from Rabbi Dov Hoffman, who, of all the people I know, was probably the greatest expert on the writings of Rav Avad Yosef, with the exception of Rav David Yosef and Rav Yitzhak Yosef. And, in fact, I shared with him before the first class, what I shared with you on the first class, the two letters that I got from Rav Avad Yosef's children. That's when I told. So I'll say to you, Dov, what I said to Menachem. When you go to see Maran in Israel, you can ask him, who does he hold by? Does he hold by Rav Avram Yosef, that us Ashkenazim can become a Sephardim if we want? Or does he hold by Rav Yitzhak Yosef, that only if we're Balei Tshuva can we become Sephardim? And by which he means, become Sephardi for good and for bad. That is, only Glock Kosher, but also Kitnios. So this is the Krach Shalromi. And he's cited by many. Faur actually quotes an article from the Hebrew Hamagid, which is a newspaper in Europe, that Chazan had the largest private library in Europe. He inherited from his grandfather, the Chikre Lev, Rav Joseph Chazan. Chazan was also the first scholar, he wasn't just a posek, he's a scholar, to investigate the Gaonic literature. He published Responsa of the Gaonim with his own notes. What can we say about Rishon Lezion Moshe Chazan? Well, there's a lot to say. First of all, I just want to point out to you that typical Sephardic authority, he is opposed to Chumrot, opposed to what we today call Chumras. He speaks of himself as following, quote, the early Sephardim, who were true philosophers and strong believers and didn't go after Chumrot, that have no source in the Talmud. So charting a middle path here between reformers and the response to the reformers of stringency. And he makes the distinction, as we saw, between those who want to reject tradition as a principle and those who are just sinners for Tehavon. And he has nothing but love for the sinners who are doing it not for ideological reasons and attempts to bring them closer to more religiosity. And this remains a Sephardic approach. Of course, it's a Chabad approach also. But if you see the way the Sephardic Gedolim, the Mordechai Eliyahu, the Rav Avad Yosef, all these people, if you see the way they relate to the non-religious in their community, not the Ashkenazim, they don't like the Ashkenazic non-religious, but the Sephardic non-religious, you see the way they relate to them because they know they're not really non-religious. They know they're just temporary sinners, but on Yom Kippur they're going to be in the shul, and you can really see the Sephardic approach. Now, Rav Yisrael Moshe Chazan did think that it would be, although he rejects any attempts at revising Yom Tov Sheni Shel Golios, he does think that it's possible to revise Jewish law in certain areas. For example, in matters which cause enmity from the non-Jews and which affect Kavod HaBriot, you know, personal dignity and major monetary losses. And he even thinks that some rabbinic prohibitions in matters of Shabbos that affect earning a living, we could revise them, but the way to do this is a gathering of all the Gedolim. You would need Gedolim from all over the world to come together and make certain decrees. But this is possible. I don't know if he's being naive here, but since you're never going to, unless you have a Sanhedrin, you're never going to get the rabbis to do this. It's really just theoretical. He lives long enough in Europe that he's able to come to some firm viewpoints about the problems in Ashkenazic society. He was in London. He saw Ashkenazic society. He's in Amsterdam. He knows what Ashkenazic society is. He speaks of the sickness of the two extremes. What are the two extremes? Well, the problems are what you'd expect. Extreme fanaticism on the one side, rejection of secular studies, adoption of chumras, and also extremism, rejection of religion on the other side. What's incredible is that he seems to have had no interaction with German Orthodoxy. The type of Judaism he's advocating is really the Torim Derech Eretz Judaism of Germany, and he never refers to it, does not seem to have any connection to it. He also sharply criticizes East European Jewry, which he must have known, I guess, from people he met or from the books, as being full of superstition. He criticizes, in particular, the kameyot, I don't know if you remember, I think he mentions kameyot specifically, the amulets, and all the superstition of East European Jewry. And here I really do think he's being unfair, because I think you can find just as much superstition in the Sephardic world as in the Ashkenazic world. Now, it might be the case that the Sephardic rabbis were not as superstitious as the Ashkenazic rabbis of Eastern Europe, but I don't even think this is the case. I mean, there's all sorts of superstitions in the world, and it's not, I mean, Sephardim certainly have it. We had someone, believe it or not, who came to this area, Essex County, New Jersey, and wanted to give away holy water. I never heard of holy water. It turns out it's a Moroccan thing. I didn't know there's such a thing, but it's not just Sephardim. Let me tell you something that appeared on my shul, my towns. We have a town website for all the shuls, mostly Orthodox, but there's a conservative shul as well. A couple of weeks ago, someone posted something how we know that it's the yahrzeit of Rivka, of Rachel in Cheshvan. So the first thing is, truthfully, I didn't know that. I never heard that it was the yahrzeit of Rachel. I heard. I didn't know how we know this. The source. It's, for those who are interested, the way they developed this is because. An early source, the Yalkut Shimoni, tells us when Benjamin was born. And if you look in Bereishit, chapter 35, it says that as she was dying, Binyamin was born, so they make then that connection. So therefore, we know we have a tradition when Rachel is born. So this woman posts something. She's actually in Israel, but I guess she used to be in my town, West Orange. And she says, there is a well-known segula. Segula is like a magical something or another, the well-known segula on the day of Rachel's death to wear a red ribbon. It can bring you all sorts of wonderful things. So Joel Rich, who lives not far from me in my town, those who read the blogs will see his name. They call him the KT guy. He comments on all these blogs, signing KT, Koltuv. He posted that before you do something like this, you should consult your local Orthodox rabbi, because some rabbis oppose it. He didn't get into details. I emailed this woman and explained exactly what he said. I didn't want to embarrass her by doing it publicly, but I told her that there are certain rabbis who regard this as akin to idolatry. Chukot HaGoyim, the non-Jewish practices. And she never heard this before. What does she know about this? And I gave her the sources, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach and Hershel Schechter and others. But then I said to her, forget that. I'm not interested in that at the moment, because I'm sure you could find some Hasidic source that says you should wear a red ribbon. And there are Hasidic sources. What I said to her is as follows. I said, you do not know how damaging this post and the other posts that you post are. I said, here we're in a town where we have the non-Orthodox also on this website. And we want the non-Orthodox to respect us and to think that this is a serious religion and to not to look down us as superstitious people and fools and all this. And here you post something that tells us and God's not interested in learning Torah and mitzvot. That's not what's going to put us in a good state. Instead, we all have to get our red ribbon because of all the things they can do for us. And I said to her, even more so, we have a struggle trying to keep the young people religious, trying to bring college-educated, sophisticated people to Torah Judaism to show that it's for everyone, it's for serious people. And here you go posting these things that that this is what God wants us to do, to walk around with red ribbons. So I said to her that this is just complete foolishness. What I could have said is, Rav Schechter quotes Rabbi Soloveitchik as saying that if something is stupid, it's usser. So if it's stupid, it doesn't need to be Chukot HaGoyim, practices of the Gentiles. It's just stupid. So we'll leave Shlomo Zalman Auerbach and all the rest of them aside. Now, because this is a famous thing of Rav Soloveitchik, let me point you out a tidbit here where I believe Rav Schechter actually gets something really wrong. Pardon me for saying that. He's the great student of Rav Soloveitchik, not me, but let me explain. In Nefesh HaRav, he has a section here on practices of the Gentiles, and this is on page 233. He has a section, he talks about hypnotism. He says they asked Rabbi Soloveitchik if it's possible to... before I go on, let me tell you that this thing that I'm going to quote to you, he quotes it in the name of I Heard. Usually Rav Schechter quotes the person who tells him. There's a number of passages where he says I heard, and a lot of these things are just completely unreliable. That is, what does it mean, I heard? It means this was the rumor in the yeshiva. People were saying it. For example, in the Sfarim blog, I quoted, Rav Schechter quotes, I heard that Rabbi Weinberg and Rabbi Soloveitchik discussed Weinberg's whole article on stunning animals prior to Shlita. Now, this was written after Hitler came to power, mid-1933. Rabbi Soloveitchik was already in America by 32. So they never had this discussion. In another place, he mentions that Rabbi Soloveitchik wrote this open letter that Emanuel Rachman shouldn't be president of Yeshiva University. And again, it's Shamati, I heard. And it's completely false. It's not true at all. And here's another Shamati. That they asked Rabbi Soloveitchik, is it okay to put someone under hypnotism just for fun? And he responds, no, it's shtus, it's stupid, and that's usser. Okay. But then the next thing is what interests me. And there's a famous story that went around YU. I heard it myself, that they asked Rabbi Soloveitchik, is it permissible in karate, if you're taking karate, you know what I'm talking about, to bow to the other person before you start a match? And they asked Rabbi Soloveitchik this. And Rabbi Soloveitchik replies, it's usser, it's forbidden. And they asked Rav Soloveitchik, and this is Rav Schechter quotes, they asked Rav Soloveitchik, well, why is it us, sir? There's no idolatry here. It's just a way, look, didn't Barack Obama bow down to the emperor the other day? They asked him, there's no idolatry in it, so what's the problem? And Rav Soloveitchik replied that it's us, sir, because it's stupid. Now, not only me, but everyone who heard this story and told this story understood it to be a joke. The Rav's not speaking halachically here. He's not, he's joking. You're asking him, is it permissible to do it? He says, no, it's us. He says, why is it us? It's us because it's stupid. What do you need to bow for? Just start the karate match. Rav Schechter quotes this, halacha l'maisa, in here as a real psak. That if it's a minhag shtus, if it's stupid, that has the status of being forbidden, etc., etc. And I can't for the life of me believe that that's what the Rav meant. No one who ever told this story, and this was a famous story, ever thought that the Rav was doing anything other than showing the Rav's famous sense of humor, that it's us, sir, because it's stupid. All I can say is I find it amazing. Rav Schechter quotes it as an actual psak, halacha l'maisa. So, I don't know. But I think that the red ribbon would fall into that category as well. No, it's not that. It's not, you can bow as a sign of respect, but that he's bowing for karate. The Rav's point was, what do you need to bow for? Just start the karate match. I mean, I don't see how anyone could take it seriously. The whole thing is a joke. What does the Rav know about karate? Here, let me read you. But that's why it's so funny, and I'm nothing to Rav Schechter, especially, and 100 times nothing when it's talking about Rabbi Soloveitchik. But we all knew the story, and we all understood it to be a joke. And let me read it to you. Asur lanu hitasek v'puot v'hanhago shal shtus. And Rav Schechter actually puts the word stupid. He spells it out. So I don't know. One day I'll ask him when I see him. He comes to my town every month or so, and I'm going to ask him why he sees this as not just the Rav joking around with the students. I'm sure he had a big smile on his face when he said it. And then it became part of the yeshiva lore that the Rav said you can't bow because it's stupid to bow. By the way, there's those who went to YU, you know Dr. Sober, who Chaim Sober, a black belt in karate and also a biblical scholar. I asked him when I met him once, I went to his shul, a scholar in residence, what's more important to him, his karate or his scholarship? And he said they're equally important. So here's an example of someone who's been able to join both karate and Torah. And, who knows, maybe he's the one that asked the Rav. Okay, moving on. I do think, although I think that Rabbi Yisrael Moshe Chazan really gives the Ashkenazim a bad rap when he speaks of them as being the superstitious ones, and wait till next week, I'm going to read you what Rav Avadi Yosef said last summer about the Ashkenazim, how they pronounce words. And I think that'll be another example of, fortunately, in 50 years, they won't remember these statements, but they'll only remember his Torah. But a lot of the Sephardim look down at the Ashkenazim. Rabbi Yisrael Moshe Chazan was coming from Amsterdam. In Amsterdam, in the main shul in Amsterdam, the Sephardic shul, the Ashkenazim had to sit in the back, behind the like a little mechitza. They couldn't go sit in the main shul. So the Sephardim knew how to treat the Ashkenazim. But I do think he's correct when he says that religious fanaticism is a problem because it drives people away from the religion. You could say, well, these people are crazy, so what does Rabbi Yisrael Moshe Chazan need to write about it? But The idea that a group can be as crazy as it wants to is really not acceptable because it affects the religion as a whole, and it turns people off. I don't think you can say, and that's why many people, especially in the Haredi world, are very upset with what goes on every Shabbos in Jerusalem with these kanaim, these extremists, if it's Intel or the parking lot or anything, because if they want to be crazy in Mea Shearim, in their own shul, that's one thing, but when they go out there, they give all religious Jews, I shouldn't say all religious Jews, they don't give the modern Orthodox or religious Zionist community a bad name, but they give all Haredim and Hasidim a bad name, because people look at them and they associate all Haredim with them, so that's why many of them feel it's important to speak out, and Yisrael Moshe Chazan spoke out as well. In terms of extremism, he speaks about another area that I think he's also valuable of, and this is a criticism, I think, to a certain extent of traditional Jews, if not traditional Judaism. Many traditional Jews have negative views of non-Jews, and they put down their religions. We've seen all this, and we know where it comes from. Rav Chazan had a different perspective, you might say a better perspective. We obviously don't agree with these religions. We think they're incorrect. But Rabbi Yisrael Moshe Chazan says that they are important because they bring order to the world. He actually sees Jews and Christians as two branches from the same root. You can find that in Krach Shalromi, page 4a. He says that we have to look at not what's wrong in Christianity, and that's who he really knows. I mean, he can speak about Islam also, but he's writing this in Rome, in the Christian world. He says, let's look at what Christianity was like before, what non-Jews were like before the acceptance of Christianity. They were at a very low level in terms of basic morality. and he stresses the benefits brought to the world by Christianity, who gave morality to the nations who lived, in his words, like animals. Now, I admit that this is maybe a little hard to digest when you think of the history of Judaism and Christianity, how much Jews have suffered at the hands of the Christians. And Tzitz Eliezer, if you look in volume 13, number 12, Tzitz Eliezer is horrified by what Rishon Moshe Chazan is saying. He sees it as kissing up to the Christians, and take a look at his words. He is absolutely horrified that any sage in Israel could speak about the Christian religion this way. Yet all I would say is that Rabbi Yisrael Moshe Chazan obviously knew the history of Jews and Christians. He knew it much better than Tzitz Eliezer. Remember, he's a very educated, secularly educated person. And he knew that Jews had suffered at the hands of Christians. Jews were suffering in Italy at the hands of Christians when he wrote this. But he is trying to create a new type of relationship. He's not denying the bad, but rather he's trying to stress the positive, seeing if we can move forward. Exactly the opposite of Eliezer Berkowitz, who we're going to deal with next semester. And therefore, his attitude is, we can continue focusing on the negative, or we can at least try to start focusing on some of the similarities and some of the positives. That's obviously in the better interest of Jews, to try to see that to focus on the good rather than focus on the bad. And he also knew non-Jews in Rome who were decent people, good people, and this affected him in the evaluation of their religion. So theologically, obviously he's opposed to their religion, but he sees them as good people, just like the Meiri, who he doesn't quote because he didn't have access to the Meiri's writings. You make a good point, Dovi, and everyone knows that we have a principle that Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg quotes it many times, Tov Shava Goyim, you learn from the good practices of the non-Jews. And Rav Shalom Mesdorf is not opposed to that either. But I guess Rav Shalom Mesdorf's problem is, who says it's a good practice? You're right, the person opposing Rav Shalom Mesdorf about the Shegels would say the Iranians are evil. But that doesn't mean that they don't have good standards of Sneas. That's exactly what he was saying. And nothing that Rav Shalom Mesdorf said would have convinced him otherwise. But that's a very good point. And we'll see, actually, Chazan, some of the amazing stuff he says about learning from the Christians. He had good relationships with priests and even with the Pope. During his time in Rome, he was involved in a great dispute about an inheritance, which I'll describe in a minute. And his ruling received the approbation of numerous leading rabbis. But unique in halachic literature, it also has the approbation, the haskama, of two Christian scholars. Let me show you something right now. This comes from his book, Nachal Yisrael. Here we have, hold on a second, I want to get my pointer here. Down here, Haskamat Chacham Echad Mikohane Hanotzrim. His responsum, his lengthy responsum on who should get this inheritance, and I'll give you all the details in a minute, has approbation. He translated it into Italian, and on the other side, the left-hand side of the book, you have the approbation of the two Christian scholars, the Kohanim, or they're the priests. Let me pull it out here just a second. He doesn't translate his responsum. He must have translated it for them, because I don't think, even though they're scholars, that they could have understood the Hebrew. This is the first page. Let me show you the second page now of this letter that he translated. If you read here, let me get my... trying to get the pointer here. He's quoting the approbation from this Filippo. In the English, it's in Italian, it's Filippo Maria. It's spelled Guidi. But this is what I find interesting. Asher hu mikata darshanim. Does anyone know who the kata darshanim are? The order of preachers, the Kata Darshanim, that's the official way of referring to the Dominicans. They're the car. So it's the approbation is Dominican. V'hu omeid Al HaLimudim, he's in charge of the studies, the Beit Limud Kuf Tomas. Kuf stands for Kadosh, Saint Thomas Aquino d'Aquinas. Saint, he's at the head of the studies at the school of Saint Thomas Aquinas. Actually, I think I'm wrong when I think of it. I think Kuf stands for Collegio. So the College of Saint of Thomas Aquinas, the Humafaresh Kitvei Kodesh, and he is a explainer, a commentator of the Holy Scriptures, and then he has another approbation from another Christian scholar. I don't know of any other examples of where a Rav has approbations from non-Jewish scholars, and I'll explain to you why in a minute he felt the need for that. Okay, Neil. Neil, if you're going to be here next week, please ask that question next week when I quote you some of Rav Avadia's choice comments about how Ashkenazim pronounce words. Basically, he says the Mashiach is not going to say Shubis, and I'll quote you word for word what he says. We dealt with this in the talks in Rav Avadia Yosef, and I'll deal in more detail next week if you want to get my take on this. There really is a the Kitzur, in brief, you have to make a bifurcation, and you also have to understand a bit about the Sephardic way of the Sephardic approach of rhetoric and how rhetoric is used. You also can't take too seriously all of his comments. And having said all that, he does say things which he apologizes for and which are improper and inappropriate. He's a very complicated person. Like I said, though, in 50 years, thankfully, this will all be forgotten, and we'll only remember his Torah. But, yeah, that's been a characteristic, and it really comes, I believe, from his background. He comes from the lower class, and he's always had this great connection to the masses. And he speaks like someone from the lower class often, and he speaks that language, and the people understand what he's saying. When he talks about you know, Yitzhak Shamir as a rabbit eater, this doesn't preclude him from the next day giving a bracha to Yitzhak Shamir. He can do both these things. And what you're right, the Hurricane Katrina thing was a terrible thing to say, unless you put yourself into his mindset. But you're right, he has said some things which it boggles the mind how a respected religious leader could say these things. You're right. I don't have an accent. That's part of what makes him so fascinating. The Duke of Sussex. Okay. Well, I will check that later. I don't know who. I don't know who what the Duke of Sussex is giving haskamah to. Is it a halachic work, Chaim? In this, he's getting approbations to his decision. Who should get the inheritance from two Christian scholars? He's not getting an approbation from a Christian to say, "Well, this is a nice book." That you can find some. I'm talking about where his actual decision receives the approbation of non-Jewish scholars. Maybe there is another one. I don't know of any. By the way, he also thinks that not all Christian criticism of Jews is off the mark. As we will see, he makes changes in certain practices to prevent Chil Hashem, so that non-Jews don't mock Jewish practices. And we're going to see some of that soon. Now, let's talk about this inheritance business. In his last book, Diane Grunfeld, the late Diane Grunfeld, published a book, The Jewish Law of Inheritance, Hilchot Nachlaot, Problems and Solutions of Making a Jewish Will. It's all about how to make a Jewish will. Let me close this up here, the picture. And he has a section of this book, a whole chapter. The title is A Cause Celeb, A Remarkable Man and a Remarkable Book. Diane Grunfeld devotes 15 pages of this book, to dealing with Rabbi Yisrael Moshe Chazan's Nachal Yisrael, and states that although the man, that is Chazan, and his book have been almost entirely forgotten, it's time to revive the memory of the man, his book, and the event it refers to. Unfortunately, when Grunfeld wrote this book, he was unaware that Jose Faor had authored a whole book in Hebrew on Chazan's life. But still, I don't know how many people read Faor's book, certainly not in the English language, so Diane Grunfeld's point is well taken. Now that we have the various digital sites, so you can see the Nachal Yisrael, which has a second section, Sheri Tanacha, which is very difficult to figure out what it's talking about. It's a dialogue all about Judaism. It's hard to make sense of, but Fowler tries to explicate portions of it. Let me tell you briefly about this inheritance dispute, using the helpful summary of Grunfeld. And you can see why this is a machokas. And by the way, if you look in the approbations, you'll see numerous gedolim writing approbations to Chazan. If I remember correctly, even Shir, Shlomo Yehuda Rapoport of Prague, has an approbation in there, and many others. A man died in Ancona. Ancona was one of the papal states. There were sections in Italy that were under the direct control of the Pope. Rome was one of them. The Pope was, throughout history, until early in the 20th century, he was also a temporal ruler. That is, he had rule over certain, not just the spiritual matters, but look, in medieval times, he had armies, he fought wars. Often he had to escape from Rome, one step ahead of this emperor, that emperor, wanted to imprison him. Now he's only, I guess, a ruler of Vatican City. All in all, I think the church is a lot better off now that the Pope can actually be a spiritual leader instead of siding. Can you imagine? Let's say you're in France and the Pope, the head of your church, is at war with your country. So, I mean, it's just a crazy situation to be in. But Ancona was part of the Papal States. His name was Jacob Gallico. Jacob Gallico, he was a rich man, but he had no wife or children. His sister had died during his lifetime. Now, you might need a chart, like one of these Yavamos charts, to keep track of everything, but I'll try to go slowly. Maybe I should have made my own chart here. But you have Jacob Gallico, he dies. His sister had already died in his lifetime, and his sister had a daughter. Her name was Simcha. But Simcha also died in Jacob's lifetime. So you have Jacob. During his lifetime, his sister dies. During his lifetime, his niece dies. But Simcha had two daughters, Matilda and Rosina. Rosina also died during Jacob Galico's lifetime. But she left four small children. So what you have here is you have Jacob Gallico. He had two nieces. One niece dies during his lifetime, but this niece leaves four children, and he has a niece that's still alive. So maybe the money should go to them. On the other hand, Jacob Gallico also had cousins. So does the money go to Jacob Gallico's cousins or to the grandchildren of his sister? The grandchildren and the granddaughter and the great-grandchildren of his sister. Well, it gets even more complicated because you say even if it goes to the children of the sister, maybe it should only go to the granddaughter, Matilda, and it shouldn't go to any of the great-grandchildren. Or maybe Matilda should get half and the nieces should get the other half. Complicated, as you can imagine. Rav Chazan decides that the inheritance goes to Matilda, half of it to Matilda and half of it to the great-grandchildren, that is, the nieces of Matilda. But the cousins protested, and they went to the non-Jewish court, the papal court, claiming that according to non-Jewish law, secular law, that is the law that was they were not in papal lands. The cousins were in the outside of the papal lands. They claimed that according to secular law, they were the legal heirs. Not only that, they were much closer to Jacob than these people, so shouldn't they get it? The cousins also claimed, correctly, that they were entitled to it because of Dina de Malchusa. According to secular law, if it was a secular court, they would be given the money. But according to Jewish law, although we do believe that you have to follow the law of the land, we do not follow the law of the land in matters of inheritance. We believe that matters of inheritance are religious issues, and that therefore, if you're in a situation where Jewish law is determining it, you can't say, well, you can go to the court, but Jews are not supposed to go to the court because secular law does not trump Jewish law. Sometimes secular law does trump Jewish law. If Jewish law has an assumption, for example, about certain payments, but you make a deal, or secular law tells you you have to pay the workers, let's say, this way, well, in that way, we say Dina de Malchusa, because Jewish law is not absolute in these cases. It just tells us a good way to do things. But inheritance, we believe, is part of no different than kashrus or anything else. It's part of absolute Jewish law. We've had other great disputes on inheritance, huge disputes where each side has had great rabbis. In this case, the matter was very obvious and clear from the standpoint of Jewish law, although Chazan had to write a book to prove it. There were no rabbis on the cousin side, at least no rabbis we know of. great gadolim, all numerous great figures write letters approving, some just short letters approving, others more detailed letters with their own Torah, approving what Chazan states. And since they'd gone to the secular court, that's why it's important to have the two non-Jewish scholars, because even, what does that mean, a secular court? All the courts are influenced by Catholicism, even if it's not in the papal territory. So if Chazan, if these two non-Jewish scholars are saying that according to Jewish tradition, the cousins do not get it, well, the court is going to take that into account and presumably award it to the grandchildren. Now, I see time is up. I'll have time to take questions now. When we begin next class, just wait till next class. One of the most interesting and some of you might say unusual, shocking tshuvot, and really in the history of the last couple hundred years. It's the very first tshuva in the Krach Shel Romi, which is a long tshuva. And if you only read one thing by Rishon Moshe Chazan, download it from HebrewBooks.org. It's got to be about 20 pages, and try to read it for next class. It's 6 pages, double-sided, so 12 pages. What an unbelievable response that is. That's where we'll pick up next class. Let me see if we have any questions. I'm going to turn up the light on the screen here so I can see a little better. My eyes will be... good point by Dov, that Din Mechusa works Nechosha and Mishpat, Yerusha's Yaradea. Now, why Yerusha should not be Din Mechusa is itself an interesting point. There is a rabbi, if you look in Rav Herzog's proposed constitution, he quotes someone who's mentioned by, I think it's the Radbaz, there was a late Rishon who thought that Yerusha should also be the Din Mechusa. But that's not the accepted position. It's also a little different, because if you look at Rav Moshe Feinstein, he deals with the issue of a will, for example. If I make a will, which is not in accord with Torah law, it still is binding, though. That is, at least according to Rav Moshe and everyone, all the posts who've dealt with it, you even have pre-modern posting, that is posting from a few hundred years ago, like the Bacha, if I'm not mistaken, who say that although it's forbidden, if you do it, it's binding. Like, let's say I make a will, and I give the inheritance to the women without, you know, one of the legal fictions to do it. Although it's forbidden, from my standpoint, the women are not obligated to give up their rights. I think it's the Bach who says this, or one of the other early Achronim. He says the women are within their right to actually insist in the secular court on this. And Rav Moshe Feinstein talks about how a will someone makes, even if it's not according to Torah law, even though he shouldn't have done it, he should have done it in the court of Torah law in a permissible way, it still is the wish of the dead man, and therefore it should be followed. You don't have this in other areas where if you do something anti-halachic, it still is binding. So the will, Yerusha, is an interesting matter there. We also spoke in the Moroccan classes how the Moroccan rabbis were willing to make all sorts of takanot to change the laws of inheritance, which you won't find them doing in other areas. So it's unusual. But anyone who wants more details on these laws, here is the book. Chaim Lander, that Chazan visits Shir in Prague. Okay, good point. Does he dress? We don't have any pictures of him, and I don't know if we have any descriptions of him, so I really have no idea how he dressed. I would be shocked. Maybe we do have pictures. Someone can look online. I would be shocked if living in Rome and living in Amsterdam, he's still dressing like the Sephardic Rav. The Chida used to dress like this, apparently, so we're told, like a Sephardic Rav. But I'd be surprised if Chazan was dressed in that way. But maybe he did. I really have no idea. Stay on for another minute or so. If anyone has any more comments or questions, I thank you for your numerous comments. Yes, he would have gotten along quite well with Rav Chaim Hirschman. Wait till you see next week. And we'll return to the Tzitz Eliezer, who just can't stomach it, as I said, that Rav Avadi Yosef is much more tolerant of Rav Yisrael Moshe Chazan. In the next tshuva we'll speak about, he rejects one aspect but accepts another aspect, but the Tzitz Eliezer just can't deal with it. It's almost as if he can't even occur to him, he can't fathom that a sage of Israel were to say the things, and I'm going to quote to you from Yisrael Moshe Chazan, in this one tshuva. The other tshuvot have amazing stuff too, but they're not at all radical or controversial. I even had, for Dovi might find this interesting, I had correspondence just the other day. I got a letter from Rav Mazuz regarding one of the tshuvot of the Krach Shalomi, and I'll mention that. Okay, looks like that's it for tonight. Let me just make a quick announcement. We're going to be advertising December 24th, the evening, Christmas Eve, Nittel. I'm going to be giving a special lecture. We'll do lots of advertising. The practice of Torah study on Christmas Eve, or the lack of it. How is it that our most important practice, that of Torah study, when the Christians are celebrating their holiday, what we actually call a Chagah, not a Chag, a Chagah, that Jews put down the Talmuds and put down the Torah study works and play cards and do other things? How is that possible? Many of you have probably seen my article on it. There'll be new stuff, some good stories, stuff that's not in the article, so you can put it on your calendar. If you're one of those who would be playing cards instead of learning Torah, you can tune in and we'll hear about that. We'll get back to the next clip. Yes, it was a very nice community in Rome. They lived in the ghetto. We'll talk more next class about the Rome community, because we get a reflection of what was going on in Rome. Robert Bonfil has an article, Jewish Life in Rome as Seen in the Responsa of Yisrael Moshe Chazan. So to everyone, have a very good week. If you're in America and you celebrate Thanksgiving, and if you want to see a good religious justification for Thanksgiving, check out Rabbi Mark D'Angel's email this week. They don't even say Tachnun in Spanish and Portuguese, if I recall correctly. They certainly say Psalms. I don't know if they say Tachnun. I forget. But we've spoken a lot about Thanksgiving, and if you don't celebrate it, enjoy the days off. I'll see you next week, everyone. Good night.